I'm honored and pleased and delighted that I am part of the Mises University. You people are our best hope for the future, and I'm just delighted that I can, in some small way, pass on the baton that Murray Rothbard and others have passed on to me. I'm perhaps one of the only faculty members that ever shook the hand of Ludwig von Mises, and I never washed my hands since. So if you shake hands with me, you channel Mises. You might get a little dirty, but you still channel Mises. I used to be the youngest one. I was the enfant terrible, and now I'm the old duffer. I don't know what happened. I guess when you're having fun, time goes by fast. Okay, what I'm going to speak about, the title that I've been given for this talk is An Austrian Critique of Mainstream Economics. And the way I'm going to approach that is by comparing Austrian economics with the mainstream. Why are we distinct? How are we distinct? Why are we better than the other guys? To me, if you had to come up with one synonym for Austrian economics, it would be praxeology. Now, there are many distinctions that we have compared to the mainstream, and I'm going to just read off a list very quickly. Austrian business cycle theory, non-neutrality of money, spontaneous order, entrepreneurship, ordinal versus cardinal, transitivity, antitrust, utility and welfare economics, market process, socialism, different views on capital, structure of production, indifference. These are areas that I'll speak about for a few minutes each. But to me, the most important one is praxeology. Now, there are other people who call themselves Austrian economists, and they have different synonyms for Austrianism. For example, one was market process. The people at George Mason once had a journal called Market Process, and the reason they picked that, I assume, is because they see market process as the most important distinction of Austrian economics from the others. I see market process as one of the top 15, but not the most important one. And also, they changed their blog to coordination economics, and I think coordination is also very important, but I don't think it's the key distinction between us good guys and them bad guys. Whereas I do see praxeology as the key. Now, the way the mainstream is orchestrated in terms of scientific methodology is that they are logical positivists. They don't believe in the synthetic a priori statement. For them, either something is absolutely true, but it's only a tautology, like bachelors or unmarried men, or indicates how we use words, or a statement is provisionally correct, but you can't be absolutely sure of it. For example, water runs downhill. It's no self-contradiction to say that it doesn't. We can conceive of it not. Whereas the Austrians, the praxeologists, see that there are statements that are absolutely true and undeniable, and yet say something about the real world. And this, for the mainstream, is cultish or religious or unscientific or what have you. Let me give you some examples of this. I think I distributed a bunch of them. Can you see that now? I think this was given out. I gave it to Pat, so she was going to distribute it. Here, this is from an article that I am in the midst of writing. I just wrote it and sent it out for publication. And I got this from Hans Hoppe, who I regard as perhaps the chief praxeologist who's now alive in the tradition of Mises and Rothbard. Whenever two people A and B engage in a voluntary exchange, they must both expect to profit from it. Now, just take that one. I'm not going to read them all. Is that necessarily true? Yeah. I mean, can you conceive of people engaging in a voluntary trade and not expecting to benefit from it in some way? I mean, suppose we trade my tie for your pen. That means that if I'm willing to do it, I value your pen more than my tie. And if you're willing to do it, you value my tie more than the pen you're giving me. Now, it might not be that you like the tie. It might be that you think that if I trade with you, I'll be your best friend forever, or I'll give you a good mark in the exam or something. Who knows what's in your mind? All we know is that if you're willing to make the trade, there's something about this tie you like more than the pen. And if I'm willing to make it, there's something about the pen that I like more than your tie, at least at the outset. Now, later, we might regret the trade. I might say, what a lousy pen. You might say, what a lousy tie. That would be a provisional statement. But it's absolutely true and undeniable that at the outset of the trade, in the ex ante sense of anticipations, the only reason we're making a trade, the only reason we do anything, is we expect to be made better off by it. You people could have been, I don't know what, sleeping or riding a bicycle or doing something else, but you're here, and this demonstrates that you anticipated that you would gain more from this lecture than any other option that you had. There are whole bunches of synthetic a priori statements, which means that they tell us something about the world and that they're absolutely undeniable. And for the mainstream, this is just anathema. This is prejudice or religion or cultism or something like that. Other examples, I'll give you a few that I came up with in addition to the ones Hans Hoppe said. There's a tendency for profits to equalize in all industries. Like if one industry has got a lot of profits and the other industry's got a small amount of profits, what's going to happen is people are going to get out of the low-profit industry and into the high-profit industry, lowering the profits there and raising the profits there until there's some sort of equilibration. There's a tendency. Can this be refuted? No, because if the profits are still higher here and lower there, that doesn't mean that there's not a tendency. There's still a tendency. And if there's a tendency, it can't be refuted. It can't be tested. You can't test these economic laws. You can illustrate them, but you can't test them. And the logical positivists who have physics envy or science envy or empirical science envy, these are the people who think that if it's not testable, it's not scientific. So this, I think, is one of the key elements of the difference between Austrian economics and the mainstream. Let me give you a little example from my PhD dissertation. I was doing a dissertation on rent control, and I had some sort of simple econometric regression equation where I had y equals a plus b1 x1 plus b2 x2, the usual stuff, plus some sort of error term. Let me zoom it better. And my main independent variable was rent control. How long did a city have rent control, or how intensive was the rent control? And this was my dependent variable was housing quality of housing. And my thesis was that the more rent control, the worse housing would be, so I expected a negative sign. And over here, I had B3, X3. The X2 and X3s were other variables that might be expected to have something to do with the quality of housing other than rent control to make sure that those effects aren't impinging on the relationship of rent control and the quality of housing. Everyone following this so far? Yes, okay. So, for example, I would have wealth, because a wealthier city would be expected to have less housing problems. Or I would have weather, because worse weather would lead to lower housing. And I even had politically incorrect things. In those days, it was allowed. You could have percentage of whites and non-whites, because non-whites would be associated with lower quality of housing, and we wanted to make sure that that didn't affect the equation. And usually, I would get negative signs, namely the more rent control, the worse housing, holding everything else constant that conceivably could have impacted the quality of housing. And I would usually get statistically significant results at the 5% level, and all was good. But every once in a while, I'd get the wrong sign. And sometimes I would get it statistically significant, which was very embarrassing, because this said that, you know, rent control is a great thing. And my dissertation advisor, Gary Becker, a Nobel Prize winner, he was not an Austrian. He was a neoclassical economist. And if he would... if he had stuck to his guns, if he would have said, yeah, we live and die by econometrics, we live and die by statistics, we're just testing the theory, he would have said, I've got this genius young student Bloch who is going to overturn everything we ever understood about rent control. He's going to prove that rent control really helps. Instead, he was too polite to say this, but what he really meant when he criticized this, he said, look, you moron, go out again and do it right until you get it right, until you get the right sign and statistically significant. So what was testing what? Was my econometric statistics testing what we know about rent control, namely that if you have rent control, and here's supply and demand and price and quantity of housing, and if you put a maximum price, you're obviously going to get a shortage and you're going to get less incentive for landlords to maintain and upgrade the housing and all that stuff. That's the basic rent control story. He would have said, this overturns all of that. But he said, do it right until you get it right. So what was really testing what was the economic law, the praxeological law, was testing the econometrics, not the other way around. Another thing came about very similarly with Cardin-Kruger. Cardin-Kruger did a study of minimum wage. And as we know from just basic supply and demand economics, when you have a minimum wage law, again, the supply and demand, and here's the wage, and here's the quantity of labor. And if you have a minimum wage above the equilibrium point, you're going to have a surplus of labor, namely unemployment. Just very basic stuff. And Cardin-Kruger did a study in New Jersey and Pennsylvania, and they said that it didn't happen. We didn't have unemployment for unskilled workers. Now, if Gary Becker and the other neoclassical economists stuck true to their so-called principles, they would have said, well, maybe economic law works differently in New Jersey. Or maybe economic law only works 95% of the time, and this is one of the times where it doesn't work. That would have been compatible with their theory. But instead, they came out with real fire in their eyes. These were the right-wing neoclassicists, whereas the Cardin-Kruger were the left-wing ones. And they said, we're going to show that this is nonsense. And they try to replicate the statistics. Replicatability is one of the essences of the of their philosophy. And they couldn't replicate it. Namely, they'd call somebody and say, well, how many guys did you hire? And the guy said, I don't know, or whatever. Namely, they couldn't replicate it. And then they did other studies to show that this was wrong. But the mere fact that they rejected this instinctively shows that if you scratch a good neoclassical economist, you'll find an Austrian. But they won't admit that. They still think that we're cultists or religious or whatever. Okay, so that's one of the, I think that's the key difference between the Austrians and the neoclassicists, praxeology, that we see economic law as a law. Now, I don't want you to think that we're snarky or snotty or something and we think we can't be wrong, our way or the highway. Mises always recognized that we could be mistaken. We're only human beings. We can err. But we see economics not as a branch of empirical science, but rather as a branch of logic. Look, logicians can make a mistake. We have the Pythagorean theorem. Pythagorean theorem says that, if you have a right triangle, then the A, B, C, so you get A square plus B square equals C square. Now, that's a law of geometry, the Pythagorean theorem. What we would say is that if you had a triangle and this didn't work and the A square plus B square didn't equal C square, then you don't have a triangle. We're not testing this. We deduce from it. So the idea here is that Austrians see economics as a branch of logic or similar to geometry or to mathematics or something like that, even though I'll say something about mathematics later where we don't input mathematics into economics the way these other guys do, but we see economics as a branch of logic or symbolic logic or geometry or things like that, which doesn't mean that you can't be mistaken. You can be mistaken. We have to have some modesty here. We're not saying that we know everything and everything is correct that we know. We're just saying that it's a different kind of knowledge. It's not an empirical science. It's a branch of logic. Now, Milton Friedman rejected Austrian economics, and he said, well, suppose two neoclassicists disagree. Well, then they go and do tests. They have empirical econometric studies. But if two Austrian economists, two praxeologists disagree, they can only fight. Well, that's silly. It's as if two geometricians disagree. They can only fight? No, they go back over the logic. So it's a different kind of a branch of science. It's a science in the sense of systematic knowledge, but it's not an empirical science. And then some people say, well, we're against all statistics. No, we're not against statistics. This is a misunderstanding of Austrian economics. The statistics can illustrate the theory, but they can't test it. Just like the statistics could illustrate the Pythagorean theorem, but they don't test it. This is another misunderstanding or misapprehension of what Austrian economics is. We're not against empirical work. Now, we do have some differences. Jeff Herbener and I disagree on this. He thinks that statistical econometric stuff is just worthless, and they call me Walter Moderate Block, and I take the view that it has some value. You see, I'm the moderate, but Herbener, the extremist, he's a radical. I think he's a terrorist. I'm not sure about that. But I'm glad you laugh. I'm not serious about this. He says that statistics has no use whatsoever. The mainstream says it's only statistics, and the dog is statistics and the tail is theory. And the moderate position is, statistics have some value. They can illustrate the thing because, you know, some people learn through empirical examples and other people learn through the logic, and you try to use both. So that would be my moderate Austrian position. Okay, I've spoken enough about praxeology. The reason I mention it so much is that there are other Austrian economists, George Mason, and you ask them, what is Austrian economics about? And they'll mention 15 or 20 different things, of which I'm now going to mention a few, and they don't mention praxeology. Whereas to me, this is the essence of it. This is the key element of our distinctiveness. And they just sort of throw out the baby with the bathwater or something. They're misconstruing Austrian economics by not making this front and center, or at least including it in the top 15, and some of them reject it. Hayek, for example, rejected it. He said, I like Mises. I think Mises was a great guy. Mises was his teacher. But I don't follow Mises into praxeology. Hayek made great contributions in many areas of Austrian economics, mainly business cycle theory. But he didn't follow Mises in this regard, and I think this is a very important regard, which is why the Mises Institute in general and me personally, I'm much more of a follower of Mises and Rothbard than of Hayek and other people like Kirzner who didn't really get involved in this. So there is, even within the small Austrian school, a bit of a divergence in the emphasis that you place on praxeology. Okay, let's now talk a little bit about some of the other elements of Austrian economics versus the mainstream. The next one, perhaps the most important one, and I've got them in a list that not really in the order of the most importance, just sort of a random list because I don't make any distinctions between them as to their importance. I just put praxeology top of the list and the others all follow. The next one would be the Austrian business cycle theory. We have a very different theory than the mainstream. For the mainstream, you get some sort of Keynesian cross, and here is income, and here is expenditure. And you have a consumption function, and this would be full employment. And you can see that if only we had consumption, we would be at vastly below full employment. But then, happily, we have investment. So this is C plus I. But even C plus I doesn't let you out all the way toward full employment. And now we have, thank God, government, which will add to it. And if the government is only this much, so we have C plus I plus G, we're still at unemployment. And if the government spends too much, then we're at over full employment or inflation. So this would be the unemployment area, and this would be the inflation area. But thanks to Ben Bernanke, we're going to hit it just exactly right. And now we're exactly at full employment with no inflation, and everything is groovy. And that's the way the mainstream looks at the sort of a thing. There are a lot of problems with this. I'll get into some of them. One of them is they just sort of see investment as a blob, B-L-O-B, like, I don't know, the creature from the blob. It's just undifferentiated investment. All of this is just undifferentiated. It's just expenditure. This would be the dollar value stuff. They just see it as expenditure, whereas the Austrians have much more of a disaggregated analysis for the Austrians. And here, I owe a lot to Hayek, and even more so, perhaps, well, not more so, more to Hayek, but Roger Garrison is, in my view, Hayek's chief lieutenant. He is the chief person who made something of the structure of production. So here, the structure of production is the key element. Now, the way Hayek used to do it, and the way Murray Rothbard has it in his book, you have here is consumption, here is basic, basic industry. And this would be factors of production. And as you add nature, this is nature. You add more, and then finally, this is time over here. You move down in time toward consumption. What Roger Garrison did, and I think brilliantly, is he put the triangle on its side in an attempt to make it more palatable to non-Austrians. And what Roger did is he put time over here, and then he had the same triangle, and here would be consumption, and here would be production, and time moves this way, and we move toward consumption. And what the Austrian business cycle theory is that this angle here is the interest rate. And the interest rate is derived from time preferences of the populace. How much saving do we want to have? How much consumption do we want to have? And as long as the government doesn't interfere, everything is sort of okay. But what the government does is it increases the money supply. And here we have some sort of money supply, demand. This would be the quantity of money. This would be money, the price, or one over the price level. And as the, well, I'm sorry, I'm doing interest rates now. And as the supply curve increases, what they do is they lower the interest rate. And if you lower the interest rate, what you do is instead of getting this moderately sized or moderately shaped triangle, you get a long, thin triangle with a much lower rate of interest. This would be a smaller rate of interest. Okay? So you'd have many more stages of production, much more investment, and less consumption relative to the whole triangle. But this is not based on the time preferences of the people. In other words, this is artificially based on government increasing the money supply and artificially lowering the rate of interest. And all of this stuff that's not like the triangle, and here I'll superimpose it, all of this stuff over here is out of sync with the consumption decisions, and all of this stuff over here is untenable. We have too much investment. Notice that it's not just like a blob, getting back to this one, where it's just investment and it's undistinguishable. Here, what the Austrians look at is what kind of investment? Heavy investment, closer to consumption. I mean, this would be wholesale, this would be retail, this would be manufacturing. manufacturing, wholesale, retail, moving toward the consumer. So the idea here is that this is untenable, and there has to be a depression, which is a cleansing of this out-of-kilter triangle. So it's a very different kind of business cycle theory than the Keynesian one. There's a little story about Keynesians. As you know, Nixon said, "We're all Keynesians now." Where did he get it from? He got it from Samuelson. And Samuelson said, "We're all Keynesians now." And when Samuelson put that in his textbook, Milton Friedman objected. And Milton Friedman says, Samuelson, who was a major Keynesian, he misconstrued this whole idea. And what Friedman really said is that when it comes to public policy analysis, there's a gigantic difference between us and the Keynesians. But when it comes to the tools of analysis, we're all Keynesians now. Well, to me, this shows that Friedman is a Keynesian, because surely the tools of analysis are more important than the public policy prescriptions, because the public policy prescriptions come out of the tools of analysis. One of the problems with the Keynesians is this thing called stagflation. See, over here you have unemployment, and over here you have inflation. And the way they see the economy is sort of like a car. It's always likely to either fall into this ditch of unemployment or that ditch of inflation. Arthur Burns, who was Murray Rothbard's faculty advisor at Columbia, who made it rough for Murray to get his PhD, but that's a whole other story, was once asked, before we had stagflation, he said, "Well, you know, if you have unemployment, you have to have more government, and if you have inflation, you have to have less government. Well, suppose you get both at the same time." And Burns said, "Oh, well, then we'll all have to resign, ha, ha, ha." Well, they got both. I mean, and if you have both, what are you supposed to do? I mean, if you have both, no matter what you do, you're going to hurt one or the other. This is just the wrong way of looking at it. And the big difference between the monetarist Keynesians and the fiscalist Keynesians, it's not much of a difference. It's the monetarist Keynesians say that the way you should move around the government is through the monetary policy, and the fiscalists say through fiscal policy, but that doesn't seem to be a crucial difference. So the two schools of Keynesian theory, the right wing, I don't know why right wing is money and left wing is fiscal. It could be the reverse as far as I'm concerned, but both are wrong. And this is a much better way of looking at it. Bill Barnett and I have an article, a 75-page article, attacking this on esoteric grounds. I asked Roger to respond to it, and his response was, "Triangles yesterday, triangles today, triangles tomorrow, triangles forever." You know where he got that. I think it was very charming, but I think the way to, you know, get to the truth of this is to have people objecting and criticizing, and so far that hasn't happened. Now, I regard the triangle, I was taught the triangle. When I think of the business cycle, I think in terms of the triangle. So I think it has good heuristic values, but I think it's wrong for reasons that I won't go into now, because this is sort of an introduction, and it's not even a focus just on the Austrian business cycle, so I'm going to move to the next subject. Okay, the next one is spontaneous order, coordination, and this is what the invisible hand, Tom Woods was talking about in his brilliant essay, his brilliant opening remark. By the way, I wrote this blog about how great it was. It was my attempt to, you know, sort of suck up to him, so he'd take it easy on me on the chess game, but he was vicious. I mean, he just beat me, and I had this great thing. I was going to say, "Tom, look over there," and then I'd move his queen or take his queen off, and he didn't fall for it. I don't know why. He's a nasty fellow. The invisible hand, language, and money came about without any guy with a bullhorn or with a noose or with a gun. This is certainly a big part of Austrian economics, but the mainstream, to be fair to them, they also adhere to this to some degree, although they focus more on equilibrium. For the Austrians, there's this market process. Yes, we're always moving toward equilibrium, supply, demand, quantity, price. But before we get to equilibrium, the demand curve shifts, and then we start moving toward this one. But before we get to this one, the supply shifts, and now we're moving there. So there's always a market process. Profit and loss is always moving us in the direction following what the consumer wants. We have a substitute good or complement good, or the weather changes or taste change, and the economy is always moving. So this is a difference between us Austrians and them thar mainstream orthodox economists. And for them, they focus lovingly on what's true or not true at equilibrium, which is of interest. We're not against that. Evenly rotating economy, what's true there. But even there, it's just a theoretical construct because, you know, if you had a full equilibrium, a general equilibrium, we wouldn't need money, and we have money. So it's more of a, in physics, they have perfect gas or frictionless systems. These are extreme cases. Just help us think. So for the Austrians, equilibrium is a device to help us put our thinking caps on. But it's not something that actually occurs, certainly not a general equilibrium. Individual equilibrium, okay, but not general equilibrium. So the mainstream focuses on what's true or not true of equilibrium. The Austrians don't focus on that. We focus on what's going on with market process. And then what they say is, well, there's market failure unless we're at equilibrium, which is just lunatic. Okay, the next one is entrepreneurship. Entrepreneurship is something that we focus on, and here Israel Kirzner has made great contributions to that. Tom Woods the other day focused on what is it that the capitalist gives to the worker, such that it's not exploitation. And what he did is he went over the Baum-Bewirth point about time and time preference. So one of the things that the capitalist gives to the worker. So the worker is time. Namely, I'm going to hire you guys to make credenzas like this. And how long is it going to be before the first credenzas come off the assembly line? Let's say a year. But in the meantime, I'm paying you. And the money is worth more now than it will be worth, or than a money now is worth to us now, money receivable in a year. Money receivable in a year is worth less than money right now, even if it's for sure, just because of the time element. So one of the things is time. The second thing is risk. The capitalist bears the risk. Suppose these things don't sell. Can I come back to you and say, hey, guess what? I got bad news for you. Remember that salary I gave you 11, 10, and 9 months ago? Give it back to me. Can't say that. I mean, I'm paying you. And you're producing this stuff, and I bear the risk. And the third is leadership. I'm the one who set up the firm, and I'm the person who receives the money afterward. If there's any money left over, I get it, and if not, not. So these are the three things that the capitalist gives to the worker. So, of course, the worker doesn't get the whole product. The labor is only accounting for about 75% of the GDP. The rest of it goes to capital and interest and profits and things like that, and it's not exploitation. Okay, the next one is ordinal versus cardinal. We Austrians are ordinalists. We're not cardinalists. What's the difference? It has to do with utility. Ordinal utility is greater than or less than. Cardinal is counting. So the way the mainstream sees it, they say, well, here is X, and here is the utility from X. And they have this sort of psychological thing that, think of beer. The first beer that you get, you enjoy, but it went down so quickly that you hardly enjoyed it. The second one you enjoy much more because now you've got the spirit of beer or something and now you can focus on it. And the third one is maybe even more. And now you get diminishing returns. And after a while, each beer adds less. There's this point of diminishing returns. So this is a psychological way of calculating. This is cardinal utility, counting utils. But there are no units of utils. I mean, there are units of speed and weight and height and stuff like that, you know, miles per hour and number of pounds and things like that. But there are no units of utility. You can't say that this pen is worth 5 utils and that this tie is worth 15 utils and therefore the tie is 3 times as valuable. I mean, that's just silly. And yet that's what this crappy diagram indicates, that you're counting, because once you put something on an axis, on a diagram, you're counting, and they're counting utils. And that's why they can have, they have this crazy thing. Here is marginal utility, this is wealth, and this is utils. And here is a rich guy because he's got a lot of wealth. And here is a poor guy because he's got very little wealth. And what they do is they say, well, let's take money, $1,000 away from him. So we'll reduce his wealth. And let's give him $1,000 and increase his wealth. And notice that we'll take less from the rich guy than the value of it is to the poor guy. Everyone following this? Yes? And therefore, it's efficient to have welfare redistribution from rich to poor. Well, not only can't you have utils cardinally, but interpersonal is even worse if that's possible to imagine. You know, like this tie is worth 15 utils to me, but 20 utils to you, and therefore I should give it to you, or I should be forced to give it to you if we want to have economic efficiency, because then we'll have an increase of 5 utils. I used to have a full head of hair, and look at me now. It's all the fault of this. I've been pulling out my hair over this crap. I mean, why can't the rich guy be on that utility curve and this guy on this utility curve? And thus, when you take money away from the rich, you lower overall wealth. I mean, these are just lines on a blackboard or on a screen or whatever. It's all nonsense, and yet the mainstream believes in that. Whereas for the Austrians, we believe it's necessarily decreasing, but in an ordinal sense, in the sense that the first dollar, the example used is, suppose you have 5 gallons of water, the first one you drink from, the second one you cook your food in, the third one you wash yourself, the fourth one you mow your lawn, the fifth one you wash your car. And now I'm a thief, and I come and I take one of your gallons of water, and I take the one that you were thinking of using to drink, namely the most important one. Does that mean you don't drink? No, you just move them all up. Namely, you use your resources for the most pressing need first, and then the next most pressing need. So it's necessarily decreasing, but it's ordinal. It's not cardinal. Okay, the next thing is transitivity. Now, these guys, they love transitivity. What's transitivity? Transitivity is, now, if I say that 5 is bigger than 4, and 4 is bigger than 3, wait, let me do it again. 5 is bigger than 4, premise 1. Premise 2, 4 is bigger than 3. Therefore, 5 is bigger than 3. Okay, no problem with that. That sort of transitivity is fine. But suppose I say I like apples better than bananas, and I like bananas better than carrots. Therefore, I like apples better than carrots? No, it doesn't follow. Because I liked apples better than bananas at time t1, I like bananas better than carrots at time t2, and now it's time t3. I might have changed my mind. Can I change my bloody mind? Do I have to always have this rank order? Well, according to those guys, yes. But this is just silly. I have a whole article about this if anyone's interested in delving into the essence of transitivity, but that's a difference between us and them our guys. Antitrust. And here, even Mises was wrong, and Murray Rothbard in Human Action, Mises was a little bit wrong on antitrust and monopoly theory. For the Austrians, monopoly is a grant of government privilege. It's crony capitalism. That's it. For the mainstream, it's concentration ratios, 4-firm concentration ratios, 8-firm concentration ratios, concentration ratios, or the thing. And if you have a high concentration ratio, then the antitrust division won't allow you to merge. And if you get too big, they'll come get you, like they were trying to get IBM for years and years. And then Microsoft beat them out. The same with Alcoa. Concentration ratios, and then there's this other thing called the Herfindahl. I never spelled this correctly, but it's something like that. The Herfindahl index is a way of measuring concentration. So for them, if you have a high concentration, we're going to have an antitrust on you. We're going to break you up or nationalize you or regulate you so you don't sell at a high price. And then they've got this crappy diagram here where here is, what is it, average cost? Here is marginal cost, and here is a demand curve, and here's a marginal revenue curve. How many of you are familiar with this sort of stuff? Okay, most of you. And here is the place of perfect competition. Oh, and they love perfect competition. They're really perverts for perfect competition. And here is monopoly, and here is that deadweight loss, the evil deadweight loss, and the monopolist sells at a higher price than the competition, and he produces less quantity. This is the quantity of monopolist, this is the quantity of competition, and there's this deadweight loss, and there's profit, whereas the profit is evil, and the perfect competitor doesn't make any profit, and the monopolist does. That's the mainstream nonsense. And what it is just a exercise in interpersonal comparisons of utility. They're saying that the demanders value the product in the area under that thickened curve, whereas it only costs this under the marginal cost curve, and therefore this shaded area here is the deadweight loss. This is just nonsense. It's sort of like, who's that great tennis player, the best tennis player now? What's his name? Djokovic. He lost most recently, but he's a top tennis player. Djokovic, probably not spelling his name right. What they're really saying, in effect, is that Djokovic should enter 20 tournaments a year, but the dirty rascal only enters 15 in order to cut back, in order to raise his price. And that we know that he should enter 20 tournaments, and if he's not entering 20 tournaments, we're going to force him to. That's the logic of what these people are saying, and this is just crazy. And you know, the Chicago School, which is big on this, Stigler was always going on about that. They love antitrust. They're supposed to be the free enterprise school. This is not free enterprise to force poor Djokovic to play more tournaments than he wants. He wants to play 15. Leave the poor guy alone, you know. And although they never put it in this terms, they put it in terms of, well, IBM or the big three auto manufacturers or something like that. Okay, the next one is, what have I got here? Indifference. They love indifference. They love indifference curves. They're just really indifference curve lovers, and here is apples, and here is bananas, and here is the budget line, and here is the indifference curve, and the market will get here. How many are you familiar with the indifference curve stuff? Okay, so most of you are into this stuff. And if we're not at this point, the government has got to get in there and move us to X. For example, if we're at point Y, the government will wisely move us in that direction. The problem with indifference from the Austrian point of view is that you can't demonstrate indifference. Now look, indifference is a perfectly good English word. We all know what it means. If somebody says, well, do you want vanilla ice cream or chocolate ice cream? And you say, I don't care, give me whatever you got. That would be a case of indifference. Or if you see three sweaters in your drawer and you pick one out, you don't really care. You could close your eyes and just pick one of the sweaters and you're indifferent, fine. As an ordinary English sentence, that's fine. It's similar to work, work in physics. What work in physics is distance through weight. You have to push a 10-pound weight through distance. Suppose you hold two 10-pound barbells like that. You macho guys, you know, you pick a lot of heavy weights. Try this sometimes and see how long you can do it. And if you can do it for more than a minute or two, you're pretty good. Even Arnold Schwarzenegger would have trouble because it's very hard. It's very hard for me to even hold my arms out like this with no weights except this pen. But if you put, if you put 2 10-pound barbells there, you will not be doing any work in the physics sense because you're not moving. You might be trembling a little, but you're not moving. So in the physics sense, you're not doing any work, but the sweat is going to be coming down your brow and you're going to be fatigued. And in about a minute, it's going to start drooping and drooping more. So in the ordinary sense, you're doing a lot of work. That's a very powerful exercise. Next time you're in the gym, try that. It's a very heavy work in the ordinary sense. So in physics, there's the technical sense of work and then there's the ordinary sense of work. Well, it's the same with indifference. With indifference, in the ordinary sense of the word, it's a perfectly good word. But in the technical, narrow economic sense of economic science, you can't demonstrate it because no matter what you do, you demonstrate that you prefer doing that to anything else. So if I buy this tie for $20, I've demonstrated that I value the tie more than the $20, and that guy has demonstrated that he values the $20 more than the tie. So no matter, you're just sitting there. Well, you've now demonstrated that you're not indifferent between sitting there and doing something else. So there's no way to demonstrate indifference. There's only way to, you can only demonstrate preference. You prefer to do this to that, you're doing this. That shows that you prefer it. So all the indifference curves go out. I wouldn't say a bitter attack on Roger Garrison, but he uses indifference curves in a journal. And if he would have just put a footnote saying, well, you know, this is all nonsense, but I'm using it just to, you know, communicate with jerks, okay, fine. but he didn't do it, so Bill Barnett and I have this article criticizing him, and needless to say, he's not replying to it. That's a whole other story. The next one is math and economics. Now, I said that we were sort of a branch of logic and geometry and math, and in one sense we are. But in another sense, we don't use math econ. The problem with math math econ is a lot of it is first derivatives and second derivatives, and in order to do that, you need smooth curves, right? Smooth infinitesimally curves that indicate, here is an average cost curve, quantity, price. And you can see it's a smooth curve. You know, it's interesting about costs. In the first chapter of every intro and intermediate text, they go on about costs. That cost is the next best opportunity foregone. Alternative costs or opportunity costs, and that's great. That's the Austrian view. And then in chapter 6, they got these crappy cost curves. Well, how does anyone know anyone else's costs? Costs are opportunities foregone. These are only out-of-pocket costs, but the main cost that you people are now paying is not the out-of-pocket costs. Most of you are coming here for free thanks to donors like the people sitting in the front table here. But your opportunity cost is what you could have been doing. You could have been working and making $100 a day or whatever it is you make, and that's a big part of your costs. Okay, so what these Cretans do, and I use the word advisedly, is they say that the bottom part of the average cost curve is great because that's the cheapest cost, and the only way you can get that is with a demand curve that's flat, and the only demand curves that are flat come from perfect competition, so that's fine. However, in imperfect competition, namely when you have any concentration ratio above 10,000 firms or something like that, what you have is a negative slope demand curve, and then the market will be at point X instead of point Y, and point Y is the least cost, most efficient point, and therefore, if you have any concentration, you're at point X, and therefore, you're inefficient. Now, Murray Rothbard, when I saw this, I practically died. I keeled over with laughter. And what Murray did in Man, Economy, and State is he did something like this. He said, okay, here is an average cost curve, a discontinuous one, and look at that. Did you get that? Did I draw it big enough? Yeah, you can see that. So now we have a downward sloping demand curve, and it's still at the most efficient point, but you have a discontinuous curve, or you could draw it this way. You get that? Here's the average cost curve. There's the demand curve. As long as it's discontinuous, their whole point about the inefficiency of concentration goes by the board. But it goes by the board mainly because of the assumption of smooth curves. And why do we have smooth curves? Because we have to differentiate, we have to integrate, we have to do all sorts of great mathematical functions. And the only way you can do that is with smooth curves. And smooth curves are contrary to human action. Humans don't act infinitesimally small. We act in discontinuous ways. You know, I'm now going to take a step, or now I'm going to take another step. I can't take an infinitesimally small step. We don't know what that is. It's just sort of silly when applied to realist assumptions, and Austrianism is a realist an enterprise. Notice that these people are sexual perverts, too, because, you know, look at where they want to put their dot. I mean, it's obvious for all discerning people. Weirdos. These neoclassicals are weirdos. Bill Barnett and I did another diagram, and we said, okay, you can have smooth curves all you want, but we're going to have a demand curve that's also not a straight line demand curve, and it too is going to get at the bottom. I can't draw it now, but you see what I'm saying? Namely, here what they have is a straight line demand curve. Another way of making Murray's point is assuming continuous curves. But now let's make the demand curve also discontinuous, and you can still get at the bottom point. Now look, you know, this is sort of theoretical. You say it's just a bunch of lines on a board. But this underlies our antitrust policy. This is the intellectual underpinning of antitrust. And antitrust is a big, big industry. I had this roommate, Ben Klein, sort of a famous economist, and he was a monetary economist, and he switched to industrial organization. And the reason was, he says, there's no money in money. And what he meant is you can't make much money as a monetary economist. The Fed only gives so much. But if you really want to make some big bucks, go into industrial organization, antitrust, economics, and whether you're an expert witness for the defense or the offense or the plaintiff or the defendant, you're going to make a lot of money because a lot of money rides on these sort of things. You know, should this cereal company be able to buy up that cereal company? It'll take 10 years to decide that. And there's a bunch of economists making big bucks off of that. And it's all based on this. And this is just dead from the neck up. It's just utter nonsense. What else have I got on my list here? I did stagflation. I did math econ. There's a whole bunch of other stuff. Let me just read some of the other stuff. Externalities. They love externalities. Market failure. The mainstream just loves market failure. The main market failures are, I guess, public goods, externalities. What else do they have here? Inequality of income? Don't ask. Unless we have equal income, well, as shown by that diagram where you can take money from the rich and give it to the poor, so unequal wealth or unequal income. I once had nothing to write about, so I got a whole bunch of American Economic Reviews over the summer. I had maybe a stack that high, and I started reading them, and half of it was just mathematical gibberish. The other half was new market failures. I mean, if you want to get tenure at a mainstream university, you want to get a promotion, go find a new market failure. My favorite one was yes man, although to be politically correct, you have to say yes person nowadays, but even yes person is no good because guess what person ends with? That's no good. So we have to say yes per daughter. That's a whole other issue. But it was the market failure was in capitalism, you'll get ahead by being a yes man and not telling the boss the truth, but telling him whatever he wants to hear. And that's a market failure. And the government's got to step in and fix this up. And there's no yes manning in government. And of course, the point is that if there's too much yes manning and the yes men don't tell the truth, then the company will tend to go broke. And the whole thing is not a market failure. But they're just into market failures, and this is the mainstream economics. Whereas for Austrian economics, the only market failure is that the market is composed of human beings, and human beings like us are imperfect. We don't have full knowledge. So that's I wouldn't call it a market failure. I would call it a human failure. There are no market failures of this sort. Let me just give you externalities, and I'm almost out of time, so I'll just do externalities. There are positive externalities and negative externalities, and the positive externalities are called external economies, and the negative ones are called external diseconomies. An example of a positive externality is education. Here is supply and demand and quantity and price. And what we're saying is that, let's say education, the amount of education you selfish rascals, want is just the amount that will get you something because you're selfish, greedy, capitalist pigs. The more education you have, the more it spills over onto other people. Like, you'll be less likely to be a criminal, you're more likely to vote well, this, that, and the other. So if we really look at the true value of education, it would not be the demand curve, it would be the demand prime shifted to the right. And therefore, this is the actual amount of education we get, but this is the ideal amount of education we get. Namely, the actual is less than the ideal. And the government, guess, you know, our friend the government, we're here to help you, will now subsidize education or in some way give you free subsidies or free scholarships or whatever. That's their argument. The criticism of it, there are several. One of them is, look, most of what goes on, I don't know about high schools, but at universities is miseducation. You know, you have feminist studies, black studies, queer studies, sociology, you know, all sorts of stuff where they just reduce the amount of education you've got. Like, take a minimum wage and rent control. Where are these the most popular? They're popular in Cambridge, Massachusetts, Ann Arbor, San Francisco. Well, what's in Cambridge, Massachusetts, Ann Arbor, and San Francisco? Lots of college kids. And what they learn is Marxism and other sort of stuff. So according to this, what we ought to do is regard that as a negative diseconomy and tax education. Then we do the very opposite of what, not that I'm saying we should do that, and we should privatize the schools, and then we'd have better schools. The usual example of this is pollution. So what you have here is, again, price and quantity and supply and demand. And this is the what's behind the supply curve is costs for the neoclassicists. And this is the actual amount of production of these credenzas. And the what's in the supply curve, what's the cost, is the explicit out-of-pocket costs. For example, I got to pay my workers, I got to pay for the raw material, I got to pay insurance, I got to pay all that sort of stuff. But there's another cost that I now impose on you, a neighborhood effect or an externality, namely the pollution that comes out of the smokestack when I make these credenzas or when we make these credenzas. And if we took those into account, we'd get higher costs, and therefore we should have ideally less production of these things. And what we should do is, Pigou, we should have a tax. Coase, we should do something different. And I'm going to get into Coase in one of my other lectures. That's Ronald Coase. But we've got 1 minute, okay. The problem with this is that pollution is a violation of property rights. It's a trespass of smoke particles onto other people. It's not an externality. So let me conclude in my last 30 seconds. Austrian economics is different than mainstream economics. The key difference is praxeology. We look at things law-like and not as mere hypotheses. And then there are 15 other things that we distinguish from those guys. And with that, I thank you for your attention.